Childers called the command post and said there was a fire in the silo. Mazzaro was already on the phone with Little Rock. Holder came down the stairs, noticed the commotion, and sat at the commander's console. The warning lights didn't make sense. Fuel vapor launch duct, oxy vapor launch duct, fire launch duct. One of those might be correct, but not all three at the same time. Holder decided to go through the checklists for a fuel leak, an oxidizer leak, a fire. One of the first steps for any propellant leak was to check the propellant tank pressure monitor unit, PTPMU, the digital readout on top of the console. It displayed the pressure levels in each of the missile's four tanks. Holder pushed the buttons on the PTPMU and recorded the numbers in his logbook. For some reason, the pressure in the Stage 1 fuel tank seemed low. It was 6:40 in the evening, about 10 minutes after the first klaxon had sounded. Ronald Fuller was going through all three checklists, too. He closed the blast valve, sealing the ventilation system, cutting off the control center from the air outdoors, and began to set up a portable vapor detector near blast door 8. It would warn if toxic fumes were seeping into the room. The gate phone rang, and Childers answered it. The PTS crew topside wanted to leave the complex. Childers opened the gate for them and then returned to the fuel vapor checklist. He couldn't understand why the purge fan in the silo wouldn't go on. The purge fan was supposed to clear out any fuel vapors. He kept pushing the purge button, but nothing happened. Then he remembered that if there was a fire, they didn't want the fan to go on. It would pull fresh air into the silo and feed the fire. "Can my people come back into the control center?" Heinemann asked. Childers said yes. He'd thought it was useful to keep Powell, Plum, and the others in the blast lock, monitoring the vapor levels on the panel. But then he remembered that the MSA automatically shut off whenever the sprays went on, so that water wouldn't be sucked into the vapor sensors. Too many things seemed to be happening at once. It felt hard to stay on top of them all. Powell and Plum entered the control center in their Refcos, Ham and Lester in thermal underwear. In the rush to get out of the blast lock, the two had left their Refcos in boxes on the floor there. Blast door 8 was swiftly closed and locked. Heinemann joined his men, and the group huddled near the door. "There's got to be a malfunction," Childers said 3 or 4 times. Too many warning lights were flashing at once. But even if it was a malfunction, the crew had to act as though the hazards were real. Childers asked Serrano if he'd ever plotted a toxic corridor on a map. Serrano replied that he'd once taken a class on it. "Well, get over here," Childers said. "You're going to watch me do it." With a map, a compass, a grease pencil, and a protractor, Childers started to plot on a map where a cloud of fuel, smoke, or oxidizer would travel outdoors. The wind speed was almost zero, good news for the nearby houses and farms, but not for the crew. A toxic cloud would hover and swirl directly above the missile complex. Captain Mazzaro was still on the phone to the command post, where a missile potential hazard team was being formed. At the direction of the wing commander, the officers and airmen on the base who knew the most about the Titan II were being recalled to duty. Maintenance and operations supervisors, the chief of safety, the chief of missile engineers, an electrical engineer, a bioenvironmental engineer, a backup missile combat crew, among others. Security police were calling homes and searching classrooms to gather the team, and a missile potential hazard net was being established. A conference call linking the command post at Little Rock with experts at SAC headquarters in Omaha, the Ogden Air Logistics Center at Hill Air Force Base in Utah, and the headquarters of the 8th Air Force at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. One of the command post's first decisions was to send a missile alarm response team, MART, to the launch complex. A pair of security officers stationed at a nearby missile site grabbed their gas masks and hurried to Damascus. While Fuller was setting up the portable vapor detector near the blast door, He overheard one of the PTS crew say something about a dropped socket. Fuller asked what had happened in the silo. After hearing the story, Fuller said they needed to tell the commander. Powell stepped forward, admitted to dropping the socket, and began to cry. He described how it fell and hit the thrust mount, how fuel sprayed from the missile like water from a hose. When he was done, the room fell silent. Holy shit, thought Holder. Captain Mazzaro told Powell to come over to the phone and tell the command post exactly what had happened. Powell got on the line and repeated the story. The details were incredible, but plausible. Things fell all the time in the silo. Nuts, bolts, screwdrivers, flashlights, all sorts of tools. They always fell harmlessly into the W at the bottom of the silo, and then someone had to climb down and get them. You could drop a socket 1,000 times from a platform at level 2 without its ever bouncing off the thrust mount and hitting the missile. And even if it did hit the missile, it would probably cause a dent and nothing more, and nobody would ever know. Half an hour after the accident, everyone realized what they were dealing with. A major fuel leak. Maybe a fire. The Dash One didn't have a checklist for this scenario. Now it was time to improvise. To figure out what could be done to save the missile and the warhead and the 10 men in the underground control center. Sid King was having dinner at a friend's house when he got a call from the board operator at KGFL, the AM radio station in Clinton, Arkansas. It sounds like there's something going on at the Titan II silo in Damascus, the operator said. A leak or something. King was the manager and part owner of KGFL, as well as its roving reporter. His friend Tom Phillips was the station's sales rep. Clinton was about 17 miles north of Damascus along Highway 65, and Choctaw, where Phillips lived, was even closer to the missile site. "Let's run down there and check it out," King suggested. Phillips thought that sounded like a good idea. They said goodbye to their wives and got into KGFL's mobile unit, a Dodge Omni that King had fitted with a VHF transmitter and a big antenna. The nickname of the subcompact, the Live Ear, was painted on both sides, along with the station's call letters. King was 27 years old. He'd been raised in Providence, a town with a population of approximately 100, about an hour east of Damascus. His father was a jack of all trades, a math teacher who also sold real estate, cut